This is another episode of the Welcome To podcast. I'm your host, community planner Zach Vega. Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association, LIAA, or LIA for short. We're a nonprofit located in beautiful Traverse City, Michigan, specializing in connecting communities around the state to the best practices, data, and media resources that they need in order to thrive in an ever-changing world. On this podcast, we talk to the people whose ideas and actions shape the places we live, work, and play. Check us out on liaa.org and be sure to follow the podcast and listen to other episodes on Spotify, Apple Music, or at liaa.org/podcast. Enjoy the show. Time for some legal copy. Financial assistance for this project is provided in part by the Coastal Management Program, Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy under the National Coastal Zone Management Program, through a grant from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, U.S. Department of Commerce. Statements, findings, conclusions, and recommendations in this podcast are those of LIA and do not necessarily reflect the views of Eagle or NOAA. This effort is part of the Coastal Management Program's Hazard Ready Coast Program Enhancement Strategy, which aims to improve the ability of Michigan's coastal communities to prepare, absorb, and recover from coastal erosion and flooding associated with Great Lakes water level changes. LIA, Michigan Technological University, and the University of Michigan serve as primary partners with the Coastal Management Program on the Hazard Ready Coast Strategy. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Welcome To podcast. This is the fourth installment of the Know the Great Lakes series. Today, we have Dr. Ethan Tierkoff from Michigan State University. Dr. Tierkoff is an assistant professor in the Department of Geography, Environment, and Spatial Sciences, and his work is focuses on coastal geomorphology and how landscapes such as beaches, barrier islands, wetlands change across timescales ranging from storms to millennia, per Dr. Tierkoff's biography on MSU's geography page. I want to thank Dr. Tierkoff for taking the time to speak with me today. I think this is another layer of understanding what's going on the Great Lakes coastline and another understanding of how the research that's coming out can help guide some of the decision-making that our communities need to make going forward, as well as I think really interesting from this talk is some of the research methods and technology that's out there to try to figure out what's going on the shoreline. So again, thank you, Dr. Tierkoff, and we'll follow up next week with the fifth and final installment of the Know the Great Lakes podcast. And I am not necessarily sad to say, but the final episode of the Welcome To podcast, we're going to close this chapter of this podcast series. I appreciate everyone who's been listening, and we'll be sure to keep these up on online so that they can continue to be streamed. But please check out the remaining episodes of the Know the Great Lakes series. And again, thank you for listening. Without further ado, here is Dr. Ethan Tierkoff.
Hello.
Hey, Ethan, it's Zach. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. You ready to go?
I'm ready.
All right. Sounds good. So first things first, what is your background and how did you end up at MSU?
So my background is interesting. So now I'm a geography professor, but I actually have no background in geography. But I guess I realized relatively recently that I am a geographer. So my background is in geology. I actually have a bachelor's in geology from William & Mary in Virginia. And, you know, I think I did like what every student does in college. I went from wanting to be a trauma surgeon to wanting to be a lawyer to, I don't know, I think at one point I wanted to be an urban planner. And then I took a geology class and I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. You know, I'm interested in the earth, so this works out. And then I took another coastal geology class and I was like, ah, this is what I want to do. You can basically get paid to study beaches. That's pretty cool. And so you know, I kept taking geology classes. I did a thesis at William & Mary working with a professor down at the Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences. Got to go down to the Outer Banks in North Carolina and study barrier islands and all this kind of stuff as an undergrad. It was a really cool experience. And then I knew that at that point I was going to go on to graduate school. And, you know, I applied around, ended up at UNC Chapel Hill at the Institute of Marine Sciences in the Department of Marine Sciences. So went from geology to marine sciences. And at that time, I was pretty sure all I wanted to do was like survey beaches. So one of the things I did in undergrad was I got to ride around on an ATV and map beaches. And I was like, that'd be pretty cool to do that as a living or do that for a living. And so that was what I did for a little bit. I had my master's thesis was sort of about surveying beaches and things like that. But then I realized that I really liked the research side of things. And went ahead and stayed on and did a PhD and got really interested in like processes. And of course, this was all on the ocean coast. So I was doing barrier island work and salt marshes, and estuaries, and thinking about how water levels drive change, storms, and all of that kind of stuff. And the overarching theme was process and sort of why do we see the changes that we do. And then I got finished with the PhD and I was like, okay, now I have to get a real job. And so started looking around and looked at some postdocs, but actually was offered a job at the Illinois State Geological Survey out in Chicago, at the University of Illinois, and took it and knew nothing really about the Great Lakes, except that there were beaches and coasts, and I could probably apply some of the stuff that I had learned there to a new environment. And came up, moved to Chicago, which was really funny because I grew up in rural Virginia, spent most of my graduate school in rural North Carolina. And then I'm like, boom, now I'm living in the big city, which was, you know, very different. Then I just fell in love with the Great Lakes. And there's just so much to do in terms of coastal geomorphology and coastal processes research that I basically haven't looked back since. It's just been really fun whirlwind for the last, I guess I've been here since 2016. Just so much fun stuff to do. And I was at the Illinois Survey. I was doing a lot of great research, a lot of applied stuff, working with coastal managers. But the thing I was really missing was teaching and mentoring and having that sort of interaction with students and getting to educate the next generation. And so this position that I'm in currently at Michigan State University opened up. They were looking to hire a professor who does coastal geomorphology, but with a particular focus on the Great Lakes. And actually the College of Social Science, which is where I sit, my department of geography sits in the College of Social Science, was really looking to develop a thematic area centered around coastlines and people. And I, like, my hire was part of that strategic initiative. So it was really a nice, you know, having fallen in love with the Great Lakes, gotten a lot of good experience with it, and then getting to teach and continue doing sort of like academic research on coastlines and people and process and all that. So now I'm in geography, and it makes a lot of sense because my stuff has always been, or my research has always been focused on sort of the spatial extent of coastal changes and how people are affected by it. So I guess I was a geographer all along. I just only recently found out about it, about that.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, especially that the position that you're in at MSU is in the College of Social Sciences, because I think a lot of people tend to think of the coastal dynamics issue on the Great Lakes as an environmental issue primarily, but they often overlook the effect that that's going to have, you know, unless you're an economic developer, the effect that that's going to have on the tourism industry, the effect that that's going to have on home values, and then the social aspect as well. How do you contend with the fact that people are strongly attached to their homes and they have to contend with this issue? Like you said, a lot of your research seems to focus around not only how human humans affect the coastal dynamics by, you know, through their development and other actions, but also how those coastal dynamics affect people. So the relationship between the two. How did you come about sort of understanding this relationship, and what questions are you asking now in your research?
You know, I think it with coastal stuff, it just comes up very organically. I mean, I think there are scientific disciplines where you maybe have to stretch a little bit more to find that applied aspect, right? Coastal research is not one of those. I think we love the coast. We love being at the coast as humans. And so there's just like this inherent linkage between people and the coast. And you said it like spot on that it's a two-way street, right? Like we affect the coast and the coast affects us. And so I think one of the things that I was doing when I was at UNC doing graduate work was a lot of my dissertation work was at a Marine Corps base. And we were initially charged with figuring out whether the marine training exercises were actually enhancing beach erosion or causing beach erosion, I guess. And that was probably my first window into, people outside of just scientists kind of understand but are interested in understanding what's happening along the coast, because this matters to them, right? Like the place I was at, Camp Lejeune, is one of the largest amphibious training facilities in the country for military operations. So if that's eroding away, that's a major national security issue. And so I got kind of interested in it at that point, and then bits and pieces throughout graduate school. But I think it wasn't really until, well, I guess I knew that I was interested in it, but then I didn't really get to apply it until I came up to Illinois. And part of what was really cool about my job there is it was jointly funded between the University of Illinois, but also the Illinois Department of Natural Resources and their coastal management program. And so I actually, for the first couple of years of my job, I was a physical scientist stationed in a downtown Chicago state government building, working right alongside the coastal managers. And so I actually got to really know in depth the kinds of questions that coastal managers are being asked, what the stakeholders are really grappling with. And I spent a lot of time meeting with community members, trying to understand different perspectives. You know, why would one community think one thing, but another one think another? And they're just miles apart, right? And so I think just getting to like kind of live and breathe that interaction and see how the science feeds into that was really formative, I guess, for making me realize that we can't do coastal science in a vacuum. And anything that I'm generating in the research realm needs to be useful for people who are making those decisions, because at the end of the day, that's why we do what we do. And so I think, you know, that really, I guess, underpins the kinds of questions that I ask now in a couple of different ways. So what's really interesting about the Great Lakes is there are a lot of things that we have figured out on ocean coasts that we don't have figured out here in the Great Lakes. And I guess a good example would be thinking about sediment transport. On ocean coastlines, we have a relatively good sense of, you know, how sand moves around barrier islands during storms and with sea level rise and things like that. There's obviously always more that we can learn, but some of that basic fundamental sediment transport stuff is just not as well understood in the Great Lakes. And I think it's in large part because we're just working towards extending that knowledge from the coasts over into the Great Lakes. And there's just a lot more people working on ocean issues than there are on Great Lakes. But I think that's changing. There's just definitely more interest in the Great Lakes now. And so, you know, the questions I ask, there's fundamental things that I'm interested in to try to get some of that basic information. But I always ask myself, okay, so, you know, if I'm a manager, how am I going to use this? What would I actually do with these information? And a lot of times I actually go the next step of trying to ask those questions to managers and people who are actually making the decisions. And a lot of my projects are either funded by those sorts of agencies who make decisions, or they're funded by groups like the National Science Foundation with the express interest of making the research relevant to people. We have a project on the Coastlines and People initiative at the National Science Foundation that's explicitly looking at those kinds of questions. So yeah, I think that's one of the things I'm really sort of always doing with my work, is trying to circle it back to people and keep that, I guess, that reality check of how does this actually help the people that need to make decisions?
And how does that program actually, how are you able to do that? Is it a working with, let's say, local officials to answer their mm-hmm. questions along with them? Or is it sort of survey work? What kind of methods are you using to kind of guide the research so that it's directly helping solve problems that local officials are seeing?
It kind of takes different forms, because I think one of the things that a lot of us who do coastal work have realized is that there's not a one size fits all solution, whether that's shore protection or, you know, management strategies, or even like how do us as scientists get our information into the hands of the stakeholders, because coastal communities are so different in their level of their level of management strategies, I guess. So some, you know, are really strapped for resources and may not even have someone who makes decisions or can look at data or anything like that. And there are some communities that are really advanced and have specific people that are shore, like beach managers and things like that. And so, you know, I think whenever we get involved in a project, it's always kind of understanding what the lay of the land is in that particular community. So one example, I've done a lot of work over the last few years working in Illinois at Illinois Beach State Park, which is a site owned by the Illinois Department of Natural Resources. And that sort of engagement has been really working hand in hand with the natural resource managers and the engineers, the folks that are actually kind of calling the shots on, does this part of the park need to be armored? What are we trying to protect? Where is the strategy? And one of the things that we actually did there, they were really struggling to understand, you know, there's miles of shoreline that's eroding away. And they were trying to figure out, like, where do we put our resources? Because we only have but so many dollars that we can put towards management. What do we do? And so we were working on actually kind of like a vulnerability valuation, I guess, for that area that sort of puts coastal habitat sort of on the same playing field as a recreational beach or a piece of shoreline infrastructure. And so I guess that's an example of, we identified where the gaps were, and I guess where, like, us as scientists, so like myself and my lab group, could actually add value to the process rather than coming in and be like, well, we have all the answers. I mean, we don't, and we didn't, and we're still, there's so much ongoing work to happen, but, you know, we try to figure out where we can kind of have that, add some value and I guess work with the process that's already in existence. So that's one example. The other one that I'm really excited about is a project that we've got going on right now that's funded by NSF, and it's part of this Coastlines and People initiative, and it's an early concept grant all about training citizen scientists to fly drones and actually map beaches themselves. And so one of the things that I have found after talking with a lot of community agencies and stakeholders and things like that, is that data tends to be one of those limiting factors in being able to make decisions. It's both data availability and accessibility. So in terms of availability, like, there might be annual photographs or regional LIDAR data sets or things like that that are collected, you know, once a year, once every 5 years or something like that, that are able to provide like a general snapshot of how the coast is changing. But anyone, if you go out to the shoreline, knows that things change a lot faster than 1 year, once every 5 years kind of thing. And so if you're trying to make a decision about maybe do I need to put more sand on my beach because all of this sand eroded away from a storm, or we had a really high lake level this past year, and what was the impact of that? I mean, things like that. Those are places where you need a little bit higher resolution data, like higher spatial, higher temporal resolution data. And so, but there's also then a cost associated with that, right? That becomes really difficult to hire, you know, maybe a consulting firm or somebody to come in and collect all those data for you. And so data tends to be like one of those limiting factors. And there may even be an issue with, there might be data, but is there anyone there that can actually work with it and make sense of it and all of that? And so drones have become so user-friendly, and they're low cost enough that we had an idea that a couple of professors here at Michigan State, Drs. Aaron Bunting and Elizabeth Mack, who are also in the Department of Geography, we were like, well, what if we tested the idea that we could train citizens to fly drones and do basically the same things that we do when we go out and study beaches? I mean, we can give them the protocols for mapping the beaches. They're going to take aerial photos at the same intervals that we do. And can they generate data that then we can, or can they generate imagery that then we can come back in and process it and make, you know, high resolution, you know, research grade data that we can give back to them. And we could add value to it by interpreting it for them, giving them results, giving them feedback. So we kind of build this network, but it's all centered around training citizens to collect data themselves, kind of empowering the communities to get that information that they need. And so that was funded last year. We've worked now with Manistique and Marquette. So we've worked in two communities in the Upper Peninsula to train citizens in that community. We kind of worked with the citizen groups to identify where the mapping should take place. And then they're going out. We had some big storms happen this fall, and the citizens went out and they actually mapped kind of post-storm and were able to document what happened. So that's more of like a direct engagement, I guess, with the communities, like empowering them to actually generate their own data and sort of, I guess, remove the veil of how complicated some of the stuff can be with science and just get them involved and in the scientific process, I guess, which I think is really, I'm pretty fired up about that as being sort of a way of the future, because I think that a lot of these methods, you don't need a PhD to be able to implement them. As long as we're sort of all working together, I think they can really be a useful tool in helping people make decisions.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Citizen Scientist Program. I think that's really interesting. So in terms of the data that people could be collecting locally, and you mentioned that drone imagery is one of them, what are the variables specifically that you're looking at, and how would those variables inform different planning decisions?
When the drone flies, it collects basically just hundreds of pictures of your survey area. And then what we're able to do is bring those pictures back into a computer program, stitch them together, and then use what's called structure from motion photogrammetry, which is basically just the principle of you're imaging like something from a bunch of different angles, which allows you to measure depth of that object. And you can get like a relief map essentially from that imagery. And so a computer program kind of does that for us. What it then is able to do is generate digital elevation models, you know, centimeter accurate, basically surfaces, 3D models of beach, dune, bluff, whatever the coastal site was, a 3D model of that coastal site. And so once we get consecutive time periods, we can actually use another computer program to difference those and generate volume of sand movement. So volume of sand erosion, volume of sand accretion. We can look at basically how has the elevation of the coast changed? So have we flattened out a dune? Have we, you know, added sand into a beach? Like all those kinds of more morphology kind of things. But then the other nice thing is the imagery, once it's stitched together, we also have a really nice aerial photograph of it that is millimeter accurate, actually. Like those are highly, highly accurate images. And so those can, we can measure where the shoreline is. We can measure from a combination of the imagery and the elevation model. We can measure things like where the ordinary high water mark is. So we can, you know, something that's, you know, typically used as like a regulatory marker. One of the things the images actually allow us to do is kind of look at the zone of like the erosion hazard zone. And so we can see like where that erosion line occurs. And so I can envision things like setbacks and things like that being able to be generated from these data sets. And then, of course, these are all spatially referenced, so we can compare them to the old data. And so we can get a really nice sense of course, you know, before and after a storm, or, you know, once a year, once every season, all that kind of stuff. But then we can add that into how did this area look 5 years ago, 10 years ago? And that's data that they're generating themselves. They're not waiting on someone else to generate it for them. So I think there's pretty much anything that's all spatially referenced, both in the horizontal and the vertical direction, we can really generate any sort of information that would help to document those changes. But then the other cool thing, it also is a data set that they can then use as a baseline for more advanced things like doing engineering designs. I mean, that's commonly, they need that sort of input data set to understand, well, if you're going to build a revetment, what's the elevation, what's all that kind of stuff. But then also, it's also an input for modeling, if we want to model how the future of these sites change. So I think it's one of those things where it's like that foundational data set that we can do a ton of stuff with. And what we actually do with it really depends on what the community needs. Some people we've talked to just want to be able to document how their coast is changing so they can use it as an educational tool to get more community buy-in on preserving the coast and doing management. Others need it to understand how much sand erodes away so that when they're preparing their beach for the summer recreation season, they know how much sand to bring in and truck in. So I think that's actually what I find really cool about this is like, you can generate one data set. It could be used in so many different ways, which I think makes it very appealing.
Yeah, I can see how that would be a really great benefit to the communities. And so one of the things that so we've covered in this podcast so far with Dick Norton from U of M and Guy Meadows from Michigan Tech is sort of a baseline understanding of the science of the coastal dynamics. And then Brian Micah from GEI, who I'll talk to in the next episode, is going to provide some kind of information on the engineering solutions that are out there. I'm interested in, so you've mentioned drones so far, but what are, right now, kind of what is the latest technology in understanding the Great Lakes, and how are you using them in your research?
Yeah, drones is definitely a big one to understand what's happening above the water. We're pretty much moving, and I say we, both my group, but then there's some other groups out here in the Great Lakes. Dr. Luke Zoot at University of Wisconsin-Madison, Dr. Robin Mateus at the University of Illinois, other folks who are doing kind of active coastal stuff are also using drones. So I think drones are fast becoming the way that we do the mapping. Guy Meadows and I actually just did a study this summer where we went back to all of his, I guess not all, about three quarters of his surveys that he's been collecting since the 1980s using traditional survey methods. And we started flying it with a drone. And it cuts the time in a fraction of what it would take to have surveyed it before. So I think it's really kind of changing the kinds of questions that we can ask and the kind of data that we can get out there and map and do things that we never could before. Kind of the in-water side of things, looking at the lake bottom, you know, I think we're still using a lot of the same technologies that we've been using for decades, but they're getting a little bit smarter and smaller and, I guess, higher resolution. So basically, depth finders are still kind of the gold standard for mapping the lake bottom. And there's a couple of different kinds. So you can have, and we call these all kinds of different things. I mean, I call it a single beam echo sounder. It's basically just a sound producing device that is measuring the depth from a transducer below the boat, measuring it down to the bottom. But we also could call it a fathometer, a depth finder. Your basic fish finder on a boat does the same kind of thing. It's really not too different from the scientific equipment that we use for mapping the lake bottom. And that's still like the best way to go out and map it. When I say it's gotten smarter, the equipment has gotten so that, like, so for instance, I use that echo sounder, but it integrates directly in with a GPS system that I have that is centimeter accurate. So when I'm out on the boat, I know exactly where I am in space down to, like, usually it's 1 to 2 centimeters at most, and I'm tracking the lake bed that precisely. And then I can take that same instrument and actually put it on a remotely operated boat. And so that's one of the things that I think is one of the coolest technologies that at least my group is implementing, is what we call a drone boat. So it's basically a catamaran. It's about 3 feet long by 2 feet wide. And we actually put a GPS system and a sonar system on board that catamaran. I stand on the shore and control it just like a remote controlled boat. And this is really what I think this does, is it changes when we can do our surveying. So, you know, in the Great Lakes, it gets really cold come fall and the winter, and harbors close down come like November 1st, right? And so it's really not safe for us to be out in small boats on Lake Michigan or Lake Superior or whatever in November and December. The little drone boat, we can safely launch it from the shore, never get wet, and have that out there mapping the bathymetry. So now all of a sudden we can map during times of the year that we've never really been able to map before, which is cool. And we've actually got a project right now where we're trying to explore how sand is eroded and transported because of winter shore ice. And between the drones and the drone boats, we now have the tools to be able to answer those kinds of questions, which have never been explored with that kind of detail before. So I think that's one of the really cool instruments that at least we're using, is the remote controlled drone boat. And then the other couple of things in terms of mapping the near shore that people are using, multi-beam. So a single beam echo sounder just has one sound beam coming out, or one sonar beam coming out. A multi-beam, as the name implies, has dozens of them, if not hundreds. And so it can actually map like large swaths of the lake bed. And so there's some teams around that are doing that. And you know, that's really high resolution. It's not able to be repeated as quickly as some of the smaller, like the drone boat, for instance, but it gives you really high resolution. So like for things like trying to find shipwrecks and things, the multi-beam is a great way to do it. And then the Army Corps of Engineers actually has an airborne system where they fly a green beam LIDAR along the coast. And so they're getting seamless topographic and bathymetric data. And about every 5 years, I think they return to different parts of the lake. So that's another exciting technology. And so the way I kind of look at it is some of those tools, we're able to use those to give us kind of a coarser grain sense of what's happening on like a bigger scale. And then we use the tools like drones and drone boats to really understand like site specific processes, to understand, you know, how and why a place is changing. And then of course there's all kinds of devices that we're using as a community to measure waves and water levels, lots of buoys, lots of smart buoys. Limnotech is really leading the way in kind of developing new smart technologies out in the Great Lakes to measure some of these and making them small. We had some really small buoys really close to shore over in Illinois that measured waves and currents. We're using a lot of kind of low cost pressure sensors, putting them on the bottom of the lake bed to measure basically waves, currents, sediments, transport, all that kind of stuff in really shallow water. I think that's another really exciting direction. A lot of the work that has kind of been done in the lakes is out in deep water. And there's also been a lot of, you know, focus on modeling efforts and things like that. And we're trying now to kind of get closer to shore and really look at some of these processes that are happening, you know, where a lot of the dynamic sediment transport is occurring. So I think that's another exciting avenue.
Yeah. Speaking of the near shore research that you're now able to do, what have you found any preliminary findings with the effect of shore ice?
Yeah, it's been kind of interesting. One of the things that we're, you know, one of the kind of prevailing knowledge, I guess, of ice is that if it's there, it's a protector. And if it's not there, then, you know, beaches can just erode. One thing that we kind of realized early on was that it's more nuanced than that. It's much more dynamic than that, because certainly in a place like the Upper Peninsula, for instance, where ice comes and, you know, once it's there, it kind of stays there, right, for the most part, and then it'll break apart in the spring. When you come down to, you know, the southern part of Lake Michigan, and even parts of the northern parts of Lake Michigan, ice becomes a lot more variable. And that's actually something that we would expect to see increasingly occur with climate change, where, you know, we have more events of like kind of freeze thaw throughout the winter, where ice might build up and then it might break apart really quickly, you know, over the matter of an hour or two during a storm event. And so what we have seen is that is going to do quite a bit of work, I guess, along the near shore. It's going to move sediment around. Certainly if there's ice or sediment entrained within the ice, it can move that around very efficiently. It becomes like, when it's broken apart, it becomes what's called brash and slush. That's really efficient at moving away from a coastal site. So you can get that kind of floating in the near shore. It can just be blown away with the wind. And so, or, you know, when ice freezes and thaws, it also can kind of act like a battering ram. And so we had some initial observations actually before we started the project that we're currently doing that sort of got at all those things I just said. You know, we saw it break apart. We saw it move a lot of sand, but we really had it constrained, you know, why the ice was doing what it did, what was the net impact. And so we started this ice project last year, and unfortunately we started it during a winter where we had very minimal ice along Lake Michigan. We did have some ice in Lake Superior, but we got our pre-ice survey and then we were grounded because of COVID. So we never got our post-ice survey. But anecdotally from some of our colleagues up there, we don't think that much changed. We had a site near the Apostle Islands. So our sites were really, what we were able to glean was the little bit of ice that formed. We were looking at Illinois was one of our sites. We were seeing that sites where there was a very gentle gradient along the shoreline going from the beach out to the near shore, ice would actually start to form like preferentially there. And places where it was a little bit steeper, ice wasn't forming. And so we probably wouldn't have seen something like that if it had been a year where there was a lot of ice, just because, you know, ice would have just formed everywhere. But just because of the minimal amount of ice, we got to see how it kind of slowly built. And so that has led us to know, or to, I guess, hypothesize that there's like a strong bathymetric control on how ice forms, which will then dictate how it interacts with the lake bed, how it's going to interact with waves. And so that's all the kind of stuff that we're now sort of exploring this winter. We're set up to do a lot of that bathymetric mapping with the drum boat. We've got a lot of tools like ice augers, underwater cameras, underwater pressure sensors. We're really going to try and identify when the ice forms, how is it interacting with the lake bed, and how does it kind of augment how currents flow underneath the lake. And then I guess the other thing that we were able to document which really doesn't have as much to do with ice as it does the complete absence of ice. We had that huge storm in January of last year that hit Western Lake Michigan. And basically, we saw more change over the course of 2 days than we had seen in the matter of 2 years. And that was really impactful. And we think a large part of that was high water levels plus no ice on the shoreline. It was basically just, it wasn't a particularly unique storm in terms of the wave heights. I mean, it's a typical winter storm for Lake Michigan. I think it was just that the ice was not there when it typically is. And so the beach was very exposed, water levels were high, and it got hammered with waves. So I think we were able to document very quantitatively that impact without ice. And now we're really excited about this coming winter where we hope to, and we've actually kind of established multiple sites to account for, even if we get a minimal ice winter, we've got a bunch of different sites. So we'll be able to get somewhere in the Great Lakes Basin, we'll get some ice and we'll be documenting it.
So you started your research on, the Atlantic coast, your profession on the Atlantic coast. What research findings from the Great Lakes do you think could be sort of act as a case study for those who are managing the ocean shoreline? And in addition to that, are you keeping up to date with sort of what's happening with the ocean coast to see how those research findings could be applicable to what you're looking at on the Great Lakes coast? So what's sort of the research relationship between those two?
Yeah. I think one of the things that like our brain first goes to think about is like, oh, well, this might be a case study for, because lake level rises and falls, and it might be a case study for what sea level rise will do. But I think there's really different scales with that sort of question. And so I don't think there's as many parallels with like, okay, with a rising lake level, we could deduce that this might occur on the ocean coast. What I think of more is some of the things that we see with like fluctuations in water level and fluctuations in states of our beaches, I think are a nice analog to extreme events and extreme sort of coastal disturbances that any coast might see with climate change. And I'll give you an example. So one of the things that we've been looking at recently is thinking about basically this moment that we're in right now with high lake levels, and we're seeing in some places 4 to 5 times more coastal erosion than we saw during the 1980s high lake levels. And water levels aren't any higher now than they were then, or well, they're slightly higher, but not, we haven't reached the all-time record high, I guess. So we're not substantially higher in terms of lake level now than we were in the 80s.
Sure. In other words, the height doesn't seem to be a large contributing factor to the shoreline erosion.
Yep. And so what is different is how we got here. And what I mean by that is, we had a period from 2000 to 2010, 13, I guess, where lake level was low for a really long time period. And if you look over the last 100 years, there was never a decade long low stand in water level like what we saw during that period. Lake level comes down and goes back up, but never for that kind of extended period. And then, it bottomed out record lows in 2013, and then it shot up to, the record near record highs that we're in right now. And I'm specifically thinking about Lakes Michigan here on right now, but certainly, we're seeing similar patterns in most of the Great Lakes. But that rate was 2 times higher for this recent rise than in the 70s and the 80s. In the 80s, lake levels were high for a really long time period. And so certainly we know that there was lots and lots of erosion, but because the shoreline, or because the lake level was as high as it is, part of what we're thinking is that, the system starts to try to equilibrate to its condition, right? And so really low lake levels in the 2000s, the coastal system was sort of, equilibrated to having low lake levels and wide beaches and all that. And then all of a sudden, the table turned and lake level rose really, really quickly. And what we've been experiencing over the last, 7 years is the system like basically being out of equilibrium, trying to work towards it. And I think, you know, that's in part why we're seeing such dramatic changes that we're seeing along our coast. But what I think the parallel is, you know, if we see abrupt climate changes, or we see, you know, abrupt changes in sea level, or abrupt changes in storminess, things like that along the ocean and estuarine coasts, then we might expect a similar response. Like systems, these coastal systems are sort of, you know, they're used to change, but they're sort of tuned to like a certain range of change, right? And so when we kind of force it out of that state, we can expect major changes. So I think that's one thing. I think that a lot of the sand transport work that we're working on doing and trying to unravel in the Great Lakes has a lot of implications for estuarine coasts. That's one of the things that I'm really interested in, are like sandy beaches along estuarine coasts, like for instance, along the Chesapeake Bay of Virginia. And I think that's another place that has been relatively understudied in terms of geomorphic processes. And I think there's a lot more parallels to that than maybe like an ocean coast and a Great Lakes coast. Like an estuarine sandy beach, I think, is going to behave a little more similarly to a Great Lakes beach. So I think there's parallels that can be drawn there as well. And then, you know, we've been thinking a lot about just some of these, you know, methods. I mean, like the citizen science engagement, there aren't really any examples of, even along ocean coasts, scientists training citizens to fly drones and collect data. So I think stuff like that is probably some of the most promising for being able to take things that we've developed here in the Great Lakes and export them to other coasts.
I think it's interesting that you brought up that there are different areas that require more research to fully understand that specific site. And you also mentioned that, you know, each site on the Great Lakes is unique in some way. So my question is, what is sort of guiding the decision of what is research, what areas are researched and which areas are left for research later on? And what is sort of what's guiding that? Is it the relationship between the funder and the research team? How do you decide which areas you're going to study?
You know, that's a fabulous question. I don't actually think anyone's ever asked me that question. So my answer is going to be very fresh, I guess. You know, I think actually, I guess the other thing to that is, this kind of is interesting because it's making me reflect on, like, why do I do some of the things that I do? Which is great. That's a perfect question. I think it's a combination of all of the above. I think there are projects that I've gotten involved in that were sort of born out of necessity at the beginning. So I guess one example would be the Illinois work. We wanted to just get a general sense of what was happening at this state park where there was a ton of beach erosion. And so we started off very simplistic with that work 4 years ago. Just, let's go out and map it, see what we find. And then it just sort of snowballed into different avenues. While out there mapping beaches, we started seeing wetlands fall in, and that got me really interested in how much carbon is actually being exported out of those eroding wetlands, because that ties in with some of the work I was doing in salt marshes in North Carolina. So I thought, well, could we do something similar here in the Great Lakes, thinking about wetland erosion? And that sort of snowballed into thinking about large-scale habitat loss and what does that mean for the provision of ecosystem services like carbon storage, but also what does it mean for management and vulnerability and all of that. And so, you know, as we were kind of cascading through those projects, then even bigger questions started to open up, like, well, okay, so if all this material is eroding away, where is it going? And once it's out in the lake, what's it doing? Is it just sitting out there? Is it moving away? Are the same processes that are causing it to erode on the beach causing it to move down the shoreline? What about sandbars? How are they moving? How is that different in Illinois versus Michigan? How is it different on a beach coast than a bluff coast? And so I think, you know, that sort of iterative step process is what I would say probably half of my work has like my current research projects, the ones that like either I have funded or my graduate students are working on, all have to do with sort of building out from these initial, why is this coast behaving this way and what does it mean kind of questions. And then there's a certain set of questions that evolve because we go out somewhere and we're like, this is really cool. Nobody knows what's going on here. We should study this. And bluff erosion is one of those. So one of my graduate students is looking at basically rates of bluff retreat over the last 40 years and trying to understand kind of the question like I talked about earlier with coastal erosion now versus the 70s and the 80s, but trying to do that throughout the entire Michigan coast. And while we're doing that, we're out mapping a bluff site in Manistee and seeing all this stuff about why this one site, one part of the site's doing one thing and another part's doing another. And so that just leads us to, you know, start asking more questions and wanting to collect more data. So I think there's always that classic science snowball sort of thing. But you know, a lot of, and I guess that would be one of the ones that's kind of like being driven purely based on like, oh, this is a cool thing, we should study this. But a lot of the work is either driven by, we're working with the Michigan Coastal Management Program, for instance, to look at sediment transport pathways. That's a really nice alignment of things that I'm doing that build off of a lot of the work we've been doing, but it's something that's really fundamental information that the stakeholders need. And then there are certainly projects that we see a request for proposals and we try to evolve it. The drone citizen science was actually one of those that kind of worked out because we had the idea, Dr. Aaron Bunting and I had the idea to like, let's train citizens to fly drones, but we really didn't have anywhere to get that funded. We actually tried to get it funded through Sea Grant and then that didn't work out. And so then we said, well, let's NSF had this call out, let's try to get it funded there. And so it kind of evolved from there. So there's definitely some of that. And then I've also got projects that I think they're up and coming to be really cool and impactful. And I guess one of those that I'm really interested in right now is looking at sediment transport in freshwater marshes during high lake level phases. We've got, you know, tons of research that have gone into thinking about what marshes, like for instance in Saginaw Bay and, you know, Western Lake Erie, like how are these marshes, you know, ecologically responding to flooding lake levels. But we really don't know much about the sediments within those marshes and whether once they flood, do they erode away? How is sand moved or sand and mud? How does that move through it? How does that change the resilience of the wetland over time? Because that has a lot to do with whether it's going to impact storm surge in the future. There are a lot of these things that are very common knowledge in salt marshes, but we don't know them here in the Great Lakes. And so that is something that my group is actually I'm actually going out tomorrow. We're going out to do some drone boat work in Saginaw Bay to try to figure out how the lake bed is moving in a place that we know was a marsh 5 years ago, but it's now covered in water. And so I think that's going to be stuff. I'm really fired up about that because I think that's going to be really important to understand sedimentation patterns and sort of what the template is in some of these wetlands that are flooded now, because eventually lake level will go down. And the question will be, all these marshes that we had in the 2000s that are now flooded, are they going to come back? And I think without understanding the sedimentology and geomorphology, we actually can't answer that question. It's not just purely an ecological question. So I think that's one that I don't have any funding for that. We're just interested in it. And I think it's going to become something cool. So that's a long-winded answer.
That's what a podcast is for. So last question before we wrap up here, and I think many people would be interested in the answer to this, but I think I guess our target audience here would be the forward thinking college freshman. So someone like me, and it sounds like you as well, who freshman year didn't know what they were going into, but they've just heard about the geology department or geography department, sorry. Or is it geology?
Yeah. It's geography.
Geography, okay.
I get that confused all the time, so no
worries. So someone who's interested in coastal dynamics, what is the question that you're looking to answer over the next 5 to 10 years that's different from the questions that we were asking 10 years ago?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think that one of the things that we probably will never be able to answer with a definitive answer is where someone's shoreline is going to be in 5 to 10 years in the Great Lakes. I think that the Great Lakes are very unique in that we have, you know, we can predict water levels pretty well out to a year, but, you know, I'm sure seen the projections, probably talked to people on the podcast. It gets really hard when you start getting out to 5, 10 plus years, right? In terms of where lake level's actually going to be. And since lake level is such a strong determinant on coastal behavior, I think being able to be definitive, and that's what people want, right? People want to be able to say, well, where will my shoreline be in 5 years? And we can give a sense of where it's been and where it might go, but definitively, probably not. So I think the big question that gets us closer to being able to answer this question that I've already said is impossible, I guess, is how does sand move around in the near shore? And I think that's going to be the big thing to tackle over the next 5 years is, all right, sand is eroding away and we know it's not sitting on the beach anymore. So where is it? And why I think that's important is, one, that sort of sets up the framework, I guess, if we were going to try to run a model and understand what might happen under different scenarios. I think that's probably where we're going to need to go with being able to predict what's going to happen in the future, is not say this is exactly one thing that'll happen, but here's a range of scenarios. What might happen if this happens or this happens? And the only way we can make good scenarios is by actually having good data about what the near shore looks like. And so I think that's important. And then where that sand goes and how it's transported during these high lake level phases, it sets the baseline, sets the foundation for how the coast sort of evolves during whatever lies ahead, whether it's lake level going up even higher or whether lake level drops. How things are moving around now really sets that up. And so I think, like, we need to be able to document that, understand what drives sand to move here and there, and sort of, can we make some generalizations? Like, if we have a storm of this character and the beach looked like this, then this is probably what's going to happen, like things like that. I think that's the kind of stuff that over the next 5 to 10 years, we need to be able to unravel to be able to get towards making more informed predictions in the future. So I think that's going to be a big part of what I'm working on, is understanding sediment transport. And I think a college freshman, that should be something that's really exciting, because there's a lot of field work involved in things like that. There's all kinds of untapped, you know, research avenues related to that that get to implement lots of cool technology. There's a little bit of everything, I think, in there. There's obviously field stuff using cool tech, but then there's also lots of space for modeling, you know, things that people are getting really excited about now, coding and, you know, getting to use like machine learning and all of these kind of high tech computing kind of things. That stuff is going to be more and more applied, I think, in the coastal realm, and kind of that fusion between the field work and sort of the computational stuff is going to be really formative for trying to understand those pathways, I guess, of sand. Sounds really basic. It seems like I should have a much more complicated answer than we're going to try to figure out where sand is going in the near shore. But I think it's important. I think it's where we need to go.
Well, from what I gathered from that, that seemed like a more specific example of what you're I think what your work really represents and what the citizen scientist work really represents, which is a need for people to be strong with data, be good at statistics to understand it, but also be strongly connected to the people who it's studying and who it's going to impact, and have a relationship with them so that, you know, you're not just sticking with the logical, but you're also looking at the people aspect of it and being able to merge those two. And I think that in planning and in your work and in a lot of disciplines right now, as data has become more available, that we're not just collecting data for the sake of doing so, and that we're making sure that it is connected to people. So from what you've described so far in the podcast, that would sort of be the overarching message to a young person going into these types of fields, is to understand the relationship between data and people.
Totally agree with that. And, you know, being able to sort of help people to utilize what's so commonplace now and what I think people would have loved to have 20, 30 years ago in terms of data for making informed decisions. I mean, we really have so much at our fingertips now. I think it's just a matter of connecting the dots and making it accessible. And I think that's, you know, some of that's incumbent upon us as scientists to make that connection and make sure that actually happens. And it's going to be kind of fun to play a part in that.
I totally agree. And I think if I were to give advice to my high school self, it would be get good at statistics and get really good at talking to people and speaking in public.
Those two seem
to be the skills.
Yeah.
We passed our hour mark, and I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I appreciate the time. I think this is a really interesting concept, and it was good to get your perspective on it as well.
Oh, absolutely. This was great. Thanks for having me on, Zach.
All right. I'll talk to you later, Ethan.
All right. Take care.
Welcome To is brought to you by the Land Information Access Association. Music was provided by Blue Dot Sessions. Thanks for listening.